not only as my guest here today, but also as a founding brother member and as a listener. And there is, or there are, artisans out there, and some that are being trained that actually will be able to rebuild Notre Dame and other cathedrals like it. So I thought that I would bring Wade on and we would talk about it. Wade Ratzi of the American College of Building Arts on the Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel, King Size Truth from Radio Size Speakers. How are you, brother?
Good, Mike. How are you?
I am well. I am well.
So great to talk to you again.
My pleasure. I was telling people on Friday's show that all is not lost. And that I had an hour-long conversation with the gentleman who is the CAO, Chief Academic Officer.
Yeah, Chief Academic Officer.
Of the American College of Building Arts. I didn't know such a thing existed, although I did read, I think Joseph had written about it. How old is the American College of Building Arts, and how did it start?
Okay, so in 1989, Hurricane Hugo came through this area, and for people who don't remember Hugo, it was a pretty massive hurricane. It at one point was a Category 5 and made landfall close to Charleston as a Category 4. About 70,000 buildings were damaged in the wake of the hurricane, and about 3,000 were destroyed. And for people who've never been to Charleston, Charleston has an amazing collection of historic buildings, both public and residences. So Charleston was the first city to declare a historic area and have rules on historic preservation. So we have a lot of houses that are preserved, more or less, at least the edifice of them is preserved in their 18th or early 19th century form.
And not only that way, but you got Bill Murray running around photobombing people. So
I've seen Bill Murray at church. I saw Bill Murray 2 or 3 years ago on Easter Sunday Mass at St. Patrick's Catholic Church down here.
Really?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
so
all right. So okay.
What happened in the aftermath of the hurricane?
Can you just slow down for just a second here, because
sure.
Folks, I don't. You probably many people will not recall this, but Hurricane Hugo was the most destructive storm in American history until Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was like, $30 billion in damage or something like that. But it was absolutely incredible. Charleston was, the entire area of South Carolina was just devastated. You can't, you have to actually really see the news footage, just see the pictures, because people like in pictures, see the pictures to do it justice. Okay, so you got all this, now what was the count of the buildings again?
The figure is something along the lines of 70,000 total buildings that received some damage. About 10 to 12,000 were severely damaged, and 3,000 were destroyed.
Okay, all right. Let's pick up from where I interrupted you.
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, your show. It hopped away. So what happened is at that point, people realized that there wasn't a core of trained craftsmen to do the repairs because you have historic buildings, you have techniques that were used to build those buildings that are no longer in use. So you have timber framing, you have the use of old lime mortars on some of the plaster, you have different bonds that were used in bricklaying, and you had carved stone and iron, forged iron, that were damaged. And there were a handful of craftsmen still active in the city. There was a blacksmith by the name of Philip Simmons, who was a really incredible African-American artisan who was still active at that point, but there just weren't enough people to fix the damage. And so one of two things happened. Either people imported craftsmen. So there's a building here called the Calhoun Mansion, which was John C. Calhoun's daughter's house that had a slate roof, and they brought people over from Wales to fix the slate roof.
Wow.
And other people who had the means imported European craftsmen, or you paid local contractors and you took your chances. And, we're coming up on the 30-year anniversary, and you can see in some of the buildings around town where the repairs that were made in 89, 90, that aftermath period, are already starting to fail because people used the wrong plaster or the wrong cement or really didn't understand what timber framing was. And so about 10 years later, once the city had kind of gotten back on its feet, a group of people, which included the mayor, Joe Riley, and a few other concerned people who were involved in preservation, said, we ought to have a school that teaches people how to do this kind of stuff.
Right.
So in 1998, it opened in its first iteration, which was called the School of the Building Arts, which was more organized around workshops and that kind of thing. And after a few years, they realized that it wasn't producing the result. So in 2004, that group went to the State Commission on Higher Education and got permission to start a college that would teach those things as essentially, we call them specializations, but most of the rest of the world would refer to them as majors. So we teach traditional timber framing, architectural carpentry, architectural stone, brick masonry, plaster, and architectural forged iron. Those were the original six specializations, and then this year we added classical architecture as our seventh specialization. And that's all put together with a semi-traditional liberal arts curriculum. So students take math, science, history, English, foreign language, but we've tailored everything to support the trades that they're learning. So they take architectural history, they take math. The math that we take is geometry and trig, you know, those that are most related to the building arts. Our students take two classes of preservation. And so we tried to marry the liberal arts and the trade classes back together because for no really good reason, at some point in history, they got separated.
What's incredible about this, Wade Ratzi is my special guest here on the Dude Maker Hotline from the soon-to-be prestigious American College of Building Arts. Now, I say soon-to-be prestigious because in our conversation on Thursday, you were telling me that the calls are rolling into the school because people are discovering that you guys exist. And they're like, hey, can you recommend a stone guy? Can you recommend an iron guy? Do you have anyone that's graduating that can do this that is an artisan in any of these fields, right?
Yeah, I mean, I never know who's going to be on the other end of the phone when I pick it up, and the most amazing calls that I've gotten were from institutions like the architect of the U.S. Capitol's building. They were trying to find a plasterer, and this wasn't a contract plaster. This was someone to work full-time on the Capitol building. They've been having difficulty finding a qualified person. I know, same for Mount Vernon. We have we've sent a couple of students their way as interns in the summer, and they're trying to find a full-time plasterer. I usually get calls looking for timber framers. I mean, you know, we went through our accreditation process last year, and I don't know if I mentioned this to you when we talked before, but we have to have our employment verified by a third party.
Okay.
And when we were going through the rules of accreditation, we were told that 70% of our students have to be employed in the field for which we trained them for us to be accredited. My response when I heard that was, well, can Harvard do that? And I think the answer is no on that one. But we're a small school. I told you this before, probably the smallest school in the country. We're going to have our 10th graduation in a couple of weeks, and we're going to, I think, be up to 103 graduates at that point.
I think that's a tremendous amount, Wade, actually. I think that's probably about the right size for a liberal arts college. You know, our friend Dr. Peter Krasnewski used to teach at Wyoming College, at Wyoming Catholic, graduating class, 175.
Well, ours is 100 in the total history, the 10-year history of the college. So we'd like to be just a little bit bigger. But, you know, we've had students who've gone on to do some pretty amazing things. But 100% of our last three graduating classes are employed. We haven't had last year's class verified yet, but I'm pretty sure we're at 100 on that. And I know that at least three of our graduates for this year who haven't graduated yet have had jobs pretty much waiting for them since September. So that's where the demand is for what we teach. And it is really, like you said, hopefully we'll be prestigious soon. We just need to get the word out because the demand for these kinds of jobs is just so great. And the other nice thing is that our students are generally paid pretty well. I mean, this is not, you're not starting off at $10 an hour or anything like that. I mean, our students do pretty well in the market because it is a very limited number of people that have the skill set that they have.
Now, I didn't hear any mention of 3D CAD training and 3D printers to replicate some of the woodwork and stonework.
There is a modern component to what we do. So our students take hand drawing and drafting in their first year, and then they learn CAD in their second year.
Okay.
Our architectural students will be learning, BIM, Building Information Management, which is just another kind of more highfalutin version of CAD. There are some applications where a 3D printer would be useful. So, for example, when you do plaster conservation or plaster restoration, you're going to have to probably make molds of the ornamental pieces of plaster.
Oh, yeah.
So we make them out of silicone. And once you've kind of hand-carved one, if you had a 3D printer, if you were making multiple pieces, you could use the 3D printer to copy the hand-carved one and speed up the process of actually reproducing the plaster so that you could fill 7 or 8 molds at a time and not have to wait for it to dry and then remove the one piece and then start it over, or to have to individually carve each one. We want students to learn how to do things by hand, but there are, modern applications that we feel are not, total shortcuts, the way something like doing like the kind of what we call CNC, the computer aided carving and things like that. We're not up on that, but there are some 3D printer applications out there that, we could do that would still stay true to the idea of artisanship.
Sure. So the American College of Building Arts in Charleston, South Carolina, and the chief academic officer, Wade Ratzey, is on the Dude Maker hotline with us. I was reading some of the stats about how they built and what's inside of Notre Dame Cathedral, what was inside of Notre Dame Cathedral. And there was a great piece, and I thought of you on Friday. I don't know if you saw it or not, but it was at the American Conservative Magazine website. And the guy was, as a matter of fact, I did a double take because I had just talked to you. And I said, I wonder if Wade has read this. Why rebuild a Gothic addition to Notre Dame? And this is written by Duncan Stroik, I believe is his name. And he tells the story in here of the spire that we all saw burning in Notre Dame was designed by Eugene Violet Leduc, a French architect and a really good one, and he wanted this spire to be something that looked like it belonged on the original structure, right?
Right.
So they, some of the statistics I've seen of how much lead and how much wood. And then the work in the statues and on the roof and what have you that went into this thing. This guy was here. In the 1850s, the new spire was beautifully handcrafted. Listen to this. Anyway, let me get your comment on this. Out of 50 tons of lead over a wooden armature weighing 180 tons,
wow.
This hidden oak structure was part of the attic structure, which helps explain why the fire brought the spire down so quickly. The octagonal base of the spire was surrounded by larger-than-life statues of the apostles and evangelists, fortuitously removed before the fire. Above them, two levels of pointed arches were crowned by gables and gargoyles. Tall pinnacles at the corners ring the pièce de résistance. The tall canonical roof covered with croaks or crockets inspired by the crook of a bishop. On the top of the crock covered roof is a large cross topped by a cock, the rooster. 180 tons of oak superstructure was underneath that iron that we saw burning. So that's 180 tons of wood. How would they have carved? How would they have made these beams and trusses and what have you back in the 1850s? They wouldn't have had electric sawmills then, would they?
I don't think so. I mean, you had some sawmills at that point. I'm not sure if they would have been steam powered. I mean, you know, the way that they did it in the 18th century is you dragged your trees, you got the straightest ones you could, and you hewed them. And you know, I think part of what people—I know this is going to sound totally counterintuitive, but part of what people need to understand is that when you're dealing with large wooden beams, generally speaking, even in light of what's happened, generally speaking, the fire rating on those is about the same as steel, or some people tell me it's even better. Now, I have trouble believing that myself, but my timber framing professors swear to me that large beams, they're as safe as using iron in some cases, because, you know, think about it. You can't just walk up to a, 12-inch thick piece of wood and set it on fire with a, you know, with a lighter. You've got to have some pretty significant heat to do it in the first place. So I like the idea of building with organic material for something like this. But the other thing is when you timber frame, the joinery that they're using is actually a little bit more flexible than a lot of modern building materials.
Okay.
So it will actually move a little bit, and I guess Paris doesn't have to worry about earthquakes all that much, but in an earthquake situation, it's not going to crumble the way that some modern building methods were, because there is some play in it just by the nature of how you put it together. So, I mean, it is an extraordinary amount of material to think about, but I think you're going to find that no matter what you build it out of, you're going to need that level of material anyway. Maybe if you use aluminum, it'll be a little bit lighter, but still, you're going to have something supporting all of that structure. Unless you just go, like you were saying, with glass and turn it into a greenhouse, and I guess it's a different ball game.
Well, if it took 180 tons of oak to build the superstructure, the frame for the spire, that magnificent spire that we saw, one can imagine the gross tonnage of wood it would take to recreate that roof structure that was on Notre Dame.
Right.
I mean, there are. I've seen the plans. I didn't count them. You've probably seen the same thing I've seen. But I've seen kind of like an architectural view of what that roof looks like. And it looked to me like there's 80 or so beams on either side.
Yeah.
And those things are spanning. Look at the inside of the cathedral, and it'll give you an idea of what the span is. And it looks to be almost 100 feet across. From where those,
yeah.
So you got beams that are spanning 50 feet a piece. That's a mighty big tree, Wade.
Yeah, I was talking. I've a lot of our trade faculty are European, and I have two guys that teach back in our carpentry and timber framing department that are French. And I was talking to one of the guys who actually worked briefly in England, and he told me that one of the little secrets is that a lot of the English timber framing companies actually get their timber from France, because apparently the trees are stronger and they grow straighter.
Huh.
So France, supposedly, according to one of my guys, has actually a pretty good store for store of trees for doing this kind of work. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, that is a really big tree, and I know that there was some worry on the part of the French that they were not going to have trees large enough to reproduce the beams. I mean, there probably are some ways that you can do it. There are some ways of taking large beams and joining them together. And you can possibly recreate it if you can't find ones that are thick enough and straight enough and tall enough as the ones that they originally used, without completely cashing in and doing it with, you know, iron or steel or aluminum or something like that. I mean, I've heard things about titanium roofing and stuff like that that people want to do. And you know, I don't know what decisions the French are going to make, because they've got obviously their own issues and their own problems. What their environmentalists and the yellow vests and all those are going to let them do. But, you know, my hope is that the decisions that get made don't get made because there aren't people to do the work. And, you know, I mentioned to you the other day, the French probably are the one country in the world that have, well, the France and Germany are probably the two countries in the world that have the ability to put out craftsmen in the traditional way. The French have this schooling system called the Compagnon des Devoirs, which is a 10-year training program for artisans. So they actually have people that can do this. And if they can't, well, then the Germans next door probably have some. And, you know, we're happy to help, too, if anybody's interested. You know, our timber framers and stone carvers would love a chance to work on something like the Cathedral of Notre Dame.
Now tell the folks, Wade Ratsey is the chief academic officer of this soon-to-be very prestigious college, American College of Building Arts. I love the use of the word arts because artwork and artisanship have been almost completely scrubbed from any of the vocations in carpentry and woodworking and iron making and ironsmiths. You know, we were talking today when we were watching 2 weeks ago today when we were watching the spire and then the roof burned down. You know, we were talking about guilds. And back in the day, they would have had guilds. And
right.
A young man might have learned from his father, or maybe the guy down the, you know, across the way, maybe that gentleman was a timbersmith, or maybe he was an ironsmith or a goldsmith or some other kind of smith. And they would have had these guilds that you could have joined where you would go in as a young man and you would learn this vocation. You probably would be an apprentice for someone, I would imagine, and
right.
You do an apprenticeship or apprenticeships things that some of your students or people that are listening that are interested right now about this. Are there still apprenticeships?
There are around the country, and there have been some efforts by some organizations to kind of revive that system. There's an organization called ABANA, it's the Artist Blacksmith Association of North America, and then there's a Timber Framing Guild who will run classes. ABANA actually put together, excuse me, a curriculum where, you know, they sort of said, well, here are the 26 things you need to do to be able to be a, you know, kind of journeyman blacksmith. And the idea was that if you could find a blacksmith in your town,
my family was in the racehorsing business, and mm-hmm. it may be one of the last guilds left, the Journeyman Horseshoers Union, the JHU.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I noticed because I had a friend that wanted to be a blacksmith. He trained, he apprenticed for 2 years under a journeyman. And when he
right.
was done, he was a blacksmith. The union accepted him, paid his dues.
Right.
Now, we're not talking unions, folks. When I say union and when Wade says union, we're not talking about the SEIU criminals. We're talking about people that actually have a love for a vocation, for a skill, as they used to be called. So I just wanted to jump in and say I'm pretty sure the JHU is still around and is still training blacksmiths. So look, or farriers, if you will.
Right.
And it's one of these things where, you know, a journeyman horseshoer at one point in time, Wade, he would have had to go to your school to learn ironworking because he would, or steel or whatever they're making shoes out of, because he would have milled his own shoes. He'd have made them.
Right.
He didn't buy them from a company that had a steel forge. He'd have made them.
Right.
So you were. I want you to tell some of the anecdotes that you were telling me the other day. Talk about the guy that looked at this cast iron structure or whatever. I don't remember what it was. And you said, He looked at it and he goes like, I can try and build something like it, but I don't know how they did it.
Yeah. So we have a blacksmith professor here named Rick Guthrie, and Rick was trained at Colonial Williamsburg, which at the time was really one of the only places that you could get this kind of education. And he worked there in the historic shop for 18 years. So he did their apprenticeship program and then worked there for a number of years. And Charleston has a couple of really old Anglican churches. St. Philip's was the original one. And it burned down at some point in the early 18th century. And one of the pieces that survived the original church burning was a communion rail that they had used in the church, an iron communion rail that was probably built in England in the early part of the 18th century and then shipped over here. And it's now outside the church, and it's not in great shape. And Rick was saying, you know, I'd love to get a crack at doing some restoration work on that, because I've gone down and stared at that thing for years, and there are pieces I still don't know how they made. And so that whole idea of a trade secret, that's a real thing. And when guys would figure out how to do some of these complex things, they would not share it with the general, you know, the general group of other blacksmiths.
So that's where we get the term trade secret from.
Yeah.
Just like, I don't know if this is part of your curriculum, but you being a good South Carolina guy, I know that you love a good mint julep.
Right.
One of the best bourbons to make a mint julep is Maker's Mark.
Right.
So trades and skilled and farriers and smiths and what have you, they all had their own mark. So
right.
Maker's Mark is, figuratively speaking, it's the Samuels family. It is that insignia on that bottle, that is the family's mark. So, and it used to be, back in the day, you were talking about trade secrets, and somebody that was good at woodworking or stoneworking or something, he would have a mark, right? And he put his mark somewhere on the work, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, one of the other interesting things is that in Europe, that idea of the trade secret still exists. So we've had a couple of students who have gone to a fellowship in France. It's called the Coubertin Fellowship. And the Coubertin family is most famous in France for having revived the Olympics. Pierre de Coubertin helped to revive the Olympics in 1896. But I think it's his niece set up a shop in 1950, basically gave the family estate to set up a school for craftsmen.
Huh.
And we have a student who graduated in our iron department last year who's now studying for a one-year fellowship in France, and they do restoration work for Versailles and, you know, all of the major French historic sites.
Wow.
And I asked him, hey, can you send us some pictures of the stuff that you're working on? And he is not allowed. They will not let him send any pictures of anything that he's working on because they don't want their secrets divulged. And there's a point where that just becomes counterproductive, because when you're dealing with such a small group of people who are able to do these things, mm-hmm. every time one of those guys, you know, goes to his great reward, then that knowledge is closer to being lost.
Right.
And one of our other blacksmith professors, a guy named Jack Brubaker, Jack, when he applied for the job here, in his cover letter, and this was the reason that I, you know, was like, I want that guy, he said that he attended the first conference ever of the Artist Blacksmith Association of North America, and they had a German smith who came over and said, I have 500 years of unbroken master-to-apprentice tradition that I can't give to anyone. And so before I die, I want to pass as much of this along as I can. So he broke the rules to come to America and teach a bunch of American blacksmiths this accumulated knowledge. But there's a point where it just goes out. And I mentioned to you the other day, plaster is something that we are the ability to fix and maintain and restore plaster in historic homes is one of those things that's on the verge. I mentioned that the Capitol building can't find someone who can do it. And I mean, I have had a heck of a time. I had a conversation this morning with a guy who I think we're going to bring in for next year, but I've spent months looking for a qualified plaster instructor to come and help us keep our plaster program alive. And it's just something that's very, very difficult to do. And, you know, I grew up in a 1960s built house in the New Jersey suburbs. You know, plaster was something that you got if you broke your arm, right? It wasn't something that was in your house. And so if you didn't grow up in an historic house, you don't know that they used to plaster walls and plaster ceilings and things like that. So the average American has no idea that this is even a thing. So finding students who want to do it is hard enough, but finding a guy that can teach those students, you know, proved almost impossible. But I'm happy to report we're going to have a guy next year. But it's amazing how close some of these things are to just being lost knowledge. And I've had a number of people contact me that say, you know, I teach traditional boat building. I do marbling and tiling. You know, I do, you know, historic flooring, and we're a small school. We have a very nice about 38,000 square foot building, but we can't fit everything in. And so some other people are going to need to start picking up the slack because we can't do it all, unfortunately. And so there need to be more programs like this. There need to be more schools that are focusing on this. And there are a couple. There's a school up in Pennsylvania called Brynathyn College, which is a religious college, but they've started a building arts program. And one of the things that they're focusing on is stained glass, which is something that, you know, unfortunately we don't have the facilities to do here. So I'm glad they're picking up that as a, you know, area that they're teaching, because we can't do it. And obviously it's going to be something that's necessary.
Yeah, especially when you're looking at a building like Notre Dame or any Catholic church that's going to need that suffers any kind of damage, is going to need restoration, is going to have stained glass. We only have about a minute left. I just wanted you heard Emmanuel, or I call fake Emmanuel because our Lord's name was Emmanuel, so fake Emmanuel Macron, say that they were going to have Notre Dame rebuilt in 5 years. Now, how many minutes did it take to get yourself picked up off the floor after you fell out of your chair laughing?
When the fire happened, a bunch of the faculty were in a room watching it. And when they started talking about that, all of my guys were like, this is decades. This is 50 years before this is done, because one of my professors said that the first thing that they're probably going to have to do is actually build a scaffold over the whole church to cover to put a covering over the roof while they basically just do the cleanup, and then probably have to build a temporary roof to work on some of the interior restoration while they're kind of figuring out the plan. I mean, he didn't think that 5 years was even going to be enough to get us to the point where we're doing the actual restoration of the roof. I mean, it's going to take months for them just to go in and assess damage. You've got, you know, whether the vaulting is still secure and some of the stonework and things like that. So 5 years just does not seem at all reasonable to us. But what do we know? We're just a bunch of artisans.
It's a pretty big place. Look, we're just about out of time. We're going to be talking more with Wade and some of his artisans as part of our three-part podcast series on the restoration of Notre Dame. So you got that to look forward to. Where can people that are interested find out about the American College of Building Arts?
We have a very simple website. We usually refer to the place as ACBA for short. So if you go to acba.edu, that's the college's website. It has our college catalog, which has all the classes that we teach. It has our history on there, and if anybody's interested in this kind of education, there's an online application. We're still accepting applications for next year, in fact. So if anybody's interested in this kind of thing, there's still time to apply. You get about another month before we close applications for next year.
Okay, so that's acba.edu.
Edu.
All right, Wade, we'll be talking again soon. Brother, welcome back to the Mike Church Show.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be back.
All right, brother. We'll talk soon.